right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 o'clock. And Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. So it's Thursday. That means it's Triple Play Thursday. You can get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Also, we're going to talk about how do you make friends. We have some interesting questions to spark conversations and how you meet people. And also, we're going to play another round of pop-up video. So Skip Skipley is on the way. But right now, it is time for our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every other week to talk TV. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a lot of TV to talk about with Dan, and let's get him on the show. Hey, Dan, welcome.
How are you doing, Nick?
Pretty good, sir. Before we get to some of the TV stuff, you were at the ATX Festival, and you moderated some panels. Tell everybody what that is.
Yes, the ATX TV Festival is a fun thing that happens in Austin every June, so just before things get ridiculously hot, but just after things get generally hot. and it's a 4 days, usually Thursday through Sunday, festival of panels for new shows, reunions for old shows, panels with assembled network executives of various different kinds talking about the state of the industry. And it's a festival that draws mostly TV fans and TV makers and the TV media. And it's a really interesting, fun thing that I've now done the past 3 years. And it's a great chance to go meet some like-minded people and eat some food.
That's great. Well, Austin's a great town, too. And so you've been going for 3 years. How long has it been around?
This was the sixth season, as they call it, because it's TV after all.
I
so
see.
The sixth season. So I guess that means apparently half of the time. And it's stayed very steady. They've had good attendance. Lots of people have been coming out for all 6 years. Lots of media have been going out for 5 or 6 years. And it's really just a good time.
That's great. Let's talk a little bit about some of the panels that you moderated. One was titled A Network's Identity, Brave New World, or Business as Usual. And I'm assuming that this is about how television has changed and all the streaming and everything that the way people consume television now. I'm assuming that that's what this was about.
That and also how networks build up an identity and the importance of a network identity in this day and age in which many, many people don't have TV or are cutting cords or don't necessarily think of the TV shows that they watch as coming from a network. You know, there are plenty of people out there who think that all of their TV shows come to them either via Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or whatever streaming torrent site they happen to use and have no awareness whatsoever that ABC or CBS or Showtime or ABC Family is now Freeform, et cetera, that those things even exist. And so it was about how things that used to be very simply a part of the TV industry. You knew what an ABC show looked like. You knew what a CBS show looked like. You had a sense of what an HBO show looked like. It wasn't TV, it was HBO, et cetera. How it functions differently in 2017. So that was a good chat. That panel had an executive from HBO, an executive from Freeform. The Freeform executive talked about the transition a couple years ago now from ABC Family to Freeform and why they made the name change, what they were demographically trying to shift away from and shift to, that kind of thing. It was, it's sort of wonky, but it's interestingly wonky if you're the right kind of person who likes hearing about how, how networks build their content around an idea of what the networks are and then what happens when sometimes they have to change their concept of who they are.
I see. Now, were there any sort of, did anybody predict what was going to happen in the future?
There was some talk about how things are going to function involving various different platforms and over-the-top services and things like that. The question of what function an individual network has when Netflix's identity at this point has become volume and, churning out show after show after show after show and how volume can become a network's identity. I think all of these people all think that they will have their jobs in 5 to 10 years, and certainly the lifespan of a network executive suggests that for some of those people that will be true, and for others it won't be, and that in some cases their networks won't be doing what they're doing anymore. And, you know, there's no way necessarily of predicting when for example, hypothetically, WGN America might make a big push into scripted programming 1 year and then suddenly pull out of scripted programming entirely a year and a half later after, you know, the parent company sold. You know, there's just no way of predicting things like that and how they can change the face of an individual network and the overall TV landscape.
Right, right. Now, another one that you moderated was prepackaged for your enjoyment, which was about talking about adapting previously published materials. Who was on that panel? What was that like?
It was a lot of the same people, and the two panels kind of were in conversation with each other because there were a lot about how people are trying to stand out, and that was sort of the theme of both the two panels is, in a universe of all of these shows, how does anyone stand out? And part of how you stand out is by establishing an identity and making yourself into a destination. Another part is by going out after big properties that people know and recognize. And so, you know, the conversation there was about why so much of this is happening, how the international marketplace plays into wanting all of these brands, what a brand like Marvel does when it goes and brings certain kinds of shows to ABC and certain kinds of shows to Netflix, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of talk about over-reliance on brands, but also sort of the value of these IP properties, of these, you know, books and remakes and whatnot. On this panel, I really would have loved to have had a couple network people because networks have much more than cable been relying on remakes and making movies into TV shows and all of that in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And it would have been great to get that perspective. Unfortunately, we didn't have it, but it was still a good conversation about another one of the developing trends in the industry.
Okay. Now, you didn't moderate this, but you did attend a Battlestar Galactica panel. Who was there and what was that? Was that fun?
Oh, it was a ton of fun. It was a reasonable percentage of the cast, in addition to creator Ron Moore. So Edward James Olmos was there, Mary McDonnell was there, Katie Sackhoff, Grace Park, and a handful of other various Cylons and non-Cylons. And it was just fun seeing all of these people getting together and talking about the legacy of a show that a lot of people really love. The ATX Fest does one of these big reunions every year, and so most famous was 2 years ago when the reunion was the Gilmore Girls reunion.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was a major instigating factor in Netflix's bringing Gilmore Girls back because it was this vocal and passionate reminder of how big the fan base was. And definitely there were loud, enthusiastic people there for Battlestar. It was nothing at all on the level of the Gilmore Girls reunion. There was something insatiable and crazed about that Gilmore Girls reunion. I think perhaps these guys from Battlestar have just been out on the circuit so regularly that it doesn't feel like they've been gone. You know, Edward James Olmos will talk about Battlestar with anyone who wants to talk with him. Mary McDonnell pops up, you know. These people are con regulars, and so there isn't the same impact of seeing them together. Whereas with Gilmore Girls, it was 30 Gilmore Girls regulars and writers all on a stage together. This was a smaller thing, but it was still good, and it was good to see how much the cast liked each other. That's always fun. You can tell the difference between BS liking and fake and real liking.
Right.
But
right.
No, it was very entertaining.
That's cool. That's good. I mean, they have to realize how much people love that show.
Oh, for sure. And again, the fact that they really don't need to work for the rest of their lives,
right.
These people, it's completely true. My colleague Leslie Goldberg at The Hollywood Reporter wrote a great story, I believe it was last year, about the fan convention circuit and the sheer amount of money that these people can make by doing a certain amount of cons every month or every year.
Yeah.
You know, and these people will always... You know, if Katie Sackhoff wants to go to a convention, she can pick up what would be a year's salary for a good many of us to appear on two panels at a big convention.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. I'm a host at a horror convention here, and I've been hosting the Flashback Horror Convention here for since 2002, And you know, the amount of money that that a lot of these people make, and over just the course of 3 days, is pretty stunning.
Well, good for them if the market will bear it. And the fact that these BSG people are, at least the ones who are on the panel, were all very smart, very funny, all very engaging. They were all good to listen to. And so it was fun to see them, and it was fun to see the excited BSG fans there in the hall cheering and being enthusiastic.
Okay. All right. Listen, we're going to break. And when we come back, I want to talk about one more panel that you moderated, and that's for Fargo. And then I want to talk about Fargo. So hang on, because we got the news coming up right now. And then after the news, we're going to talk Fargo. And yeah. So let's get to the news here right after this break on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And your Triple Play Thursday requests, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. And we will get to that a little bit later on. We're also going to have another round of pop-up video to play. And we're going to talk about questions that you asked to break the ice and make friends. And we'll discuss that and all kinds of fun stuff. Right now, though, we are talking with Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. He's TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. He was just at the ATX Television Festival. And, you know, we were talking about some of the panels that he moderated. And let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. So you moderated the Fargo panel. who was there, and tell me what was going on there?
Well, it was just terrific. It was a huge crowd. We screened the episodes that aired last night, that aired on Wednesday, which I have now watched a few times, and it's fantastic.
Yes.
You've watched it again.
Yeah, I watched it. I did. Just a few hours ago, and it was stunning.
but we will talk about that, or yep, talk obliquely about
yep
that. But yeah, so so creator Noah Hawley was there. He's an Austin guy, so he loves to participate in things at the ATX Festival. He usually does three or four different panels of different sorts, and you know, he's always great to talk to. Producer John Cameron, who directed the LA episode earlier this season, and then we also had Michael Stuhlbarg and Mary McDonald, who, of course, since she was in town,
right,
being President Roslin, figured might as well drop in and answer a few questions,
okay,
about the Widow Goldfarb.
Right.
So, yeah, so no, it was a screen the panel, screen the episode, which was a 50-minute episode without commercials, and then did a solid 45-minute Q&A, and they're just one of the very, very good casts to talk to on TV. I've been doing interviews all season long for The Hollywood Reporter from, you know, different writers, directors, actors from Fargo, and basically I've been doing it because they're good to talk to. And then the same reason why I've been doing Better Call Saul interviews is because it turns out that smart people, when they're on smart TV shows, usually have smart things to say about those shows.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny how that works. And
yeah,
so that's a pleasure. And no, it was just a great conversation, touching on really all aspects of the season, everything from the musical choices to different performance choices. Michael Stuhlbarg talked about how it was easy to get into the Fargo accent and very, very difficult to shake out of it. Mary McDonald talked about the pleasure of getting to take a little detour away from her day job on TNT's Major Crime and to just drop in a supporting role on a show like this. It was just a good chat. Mary Elizabeth Winstead was supposed to be there. Disappointingly, she was not. I was very sad about that. But, you know, while it would have been great to have her, the conversation never slowed down. The audience had a lot of fantastic questions. That's the other great thing about ATX, is that the audience questions are just superb. Anyone who's ever been to a con knows that audience questions can be a hit and miss situation.
Yes,
that's likely to leave, yeah, you kind of mortified and horrified.
Yes, they can.
Anything? It's you know, it's unavoidable. And even at the conventions where you get five or six bad questions at a panel, you still get usually one or two good ones. Let's say the ratio is inverted in Austin. It tends to be almost all really good, really smart questions that the people on the panel are usually impressed to get. And
yeah,
it's also good because if you're a moderator on a panel like this, you can know that you can ask you know, 25 minutes of your questions, and that if you don't get to a few, that the audience is bound to get to the questions that you left out. So it was just a really good panel. I enjoyed being part of that.
I have to say, really quick, as an aside, I moderated a Q&A with John Carpenter, and someone in the audience asked him, why the hell did you divorce Adrienne Barbeau?
Did he have a good answer for that?
He's like, call her. I don't know. But he's great. I mean, he handles the Q&As really well. He knows he knows the crowd and everything, and he's a smart ass too. So it was, he ended his panel by saying, listen, this is the last question because I have to get in contact with my drug dealer. That's how he ended. That's how he ended the Q&A. Now, Mary Elizabeth Winstead was not at the panel, but you did interview her.
I did.
And you also interviewed Olivia Sandoval.
Who is so very good, and I hope that she gets opportunities out of this. For those who don't necessarily know the name yet, she's Winnie on Fargo this season, and she spent a lot of great time acting opposite Carrie Coon, and she's also veteran character actor Miguel Sandoval's daughter, and yeah, she's just very, very talented and an entirely charming interview, very much oddly like the character she plays on the show in a good way. Yeah. So great to talk to her.
Well, I have to say, there is a moment in last night's episode between the two of them is beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful.
And I did watch the episode twice last week, once the night before the panel and then once with the crowd during the panel. And to spoil nothing, because you can't even anticipate it, this week's Fargo made me cry. It absolutely, totally made me cry, utterly unexpectedly.
Yep.
Just beautiful. And a lot of people at the start of the season, when people weren't responding to the show, a lot of the complaints involved the lack of kind of heart. And I think that was my complaint after the first two episodes,
that
I just wasn't sure where it was coming from. And then suddenly in the past handful of episodes, the heart has come, it has appeared. And I think it might be even more emotionally effective because of how surprising the moments of heart have been in the past couple episodes.
Last night's episode, the opening monologue that Ewan McGregor has is amazing. Carrie Coon has so many great moments in it, like really beautiful moments. And then on top of that, Keith Gordon directed the hell out of that episode. And there are some technical stuff that's in there that's amazing. There's a crane shot that leads into a tracking shot going inside the semi trailer that comes back out and goes back to another crane shot. That's just beautiful, just technically beautiful stuff in terms of direction. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character has just really has just taken off, man. And I just love where it's gone. I really do. And I got to say, the episode before last week's episode, now we haven't talked about it because you haven't been on since then. That episode was astonishing in so many ways, in my opinion. The first 15 minutes of the week before's episode was about the best opening 15 minutes I've seen on a TV show, maybe ever. Almost entirely wordless, and just insanely suspenseful and beautifully done. And they brought back a character. They brought back a character that I didn't expect to see. And I thought they handled beautifully. And then the second segment, I thought, wait a minute, am I watching Fargo? Am I watching Twin Peaks? Because and then they jump in time ahead. I mean, it was just such a crazy episode, and I loved every second of it. What did you think of the one before?
Oh, I loved it. Some people haven't necessarily responded as well to the, let's just call it, the bowling alley scene, it requires a leap. All I'll say on that is that it does require you to go somewhere, and I went there completely, totally, willingly, and happily, and loved it. I think it was probably my favorite episode of the season until Wednesday's episode, and that was my favorite episode of the season. So, yes, they've been on a tear. This week's episode, really, as you say, Keith Gordon directed the hell out of it.
Yes, he did.
I have an interview with Keith Gordon up on The Hollywood Reporter now. Just a great chat. I mean, he, for people who don't know, you know, he got his start as a young actor, doing, you know, Brian De Palma movies, doing John Carpenter's Christine, et cetera.
Right.
And then he transitioned into doing sort of little character-driven indie movies. You know, he directed Chocolate War. He directed Midnight Clear. He directed The Waking Dead. Waking the Dead.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Zombies. Title for me. And really, he hasn't directed anything since The Singing Detective, which was not a good idea or a good movie.
Right.
But instead, he's become this amazing director of prestige cable shows, just directing on everything. And this spring alone, he directed a magnificent episode of The Leftovers, which was my favorite episode of that season, with Nora's road trip to Cincinnati and a certain sitcom character returning to the fold. Mm. He directed one of my favorite episodes of Better Call Saul of the season, and he directed the last two Fargo episodes of the season, and that's episodes that have aired in the past month. That's crazy.
Yeah,
the career he has at this moment.
Yeah, it's great, and he did a great job. And I know that I'm looking forward to the finale next week. And I know he directed that. And I'm really looking forward to that as well. And it's just been—I think it's just been a pretty remarkable season for Fargo, and consistently surprising. I did post on my Facebook page that once the season of Fargo is over, I really hope to never see a close-up of David Thewlis's mouth ever again. I'm sorry, go ahead.
They have all steered into every imaginable skid of disgustingness involving that character, and he clearly seems to be loving it.
I know he's having a great time, but I don't think I like Rocky Road ice cream anymore. I just don't think I do. So, all right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. If you've not caught up with season three of Fargo, it's on FX and FX Now. The finale is Wednesday night, it's an incredible piece of television. So we're going to take a break. We got more TV to talk about. Well, we always have more TV to talk about. Dan Feinberg is here, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and we'll have more with him right after we take a break here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. We're talking with Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV, and we welcome Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
I am very excited about the new Netflix show, Glow. Having been a wrestling fan like my entire life, and I used to watch Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling in the 80s, and also being a massive Alison Brie fan, I am very excited about this. And you did review Glow, and June 23rd is when it premieres.
Is that way? I lose track of my Fridays, but whatever is the Friday that is not 2 days from now, but is 9 days from now,
right. Yes.
I would say.
Yes.
Whatever the numbers are. Yes, I did. And you should continue to be looking forward to it because it is really good. It's whether it's great or not, I can't say. But it builds very nicely. Alison Brie plays an actress who's frustrated by the writing for women in mid-80s Hollywood, as one would be. She's also, and the show does not come out and necessarily say this, she's also really pretty clearly not a very good actress,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of the nice nuance of Alison Brie's performance. It's hard to play a bad actor if you're a good actor. And she does it very well. So anyway, she answers a cattle call to become part of the cast of a women's wrestling league that's going to do a pilot for a podunk television network. And the person putting together the pilot is a down-on-his-luck schlock director played by Marc Maron. And the other wrestlers, for the most part, are relatively unknown actors and singers. Some people will probably recognize Ellen Wong from the Scott Pilgrim movie. Some random American Idol fans will recognize that Jackie Tone was in the top 24 or 32 of some season. Some British pop fans will know Kate Nash, who's a British singer-songwriter who plays a British wrestler here who's really, really dumb, but they make her play the smart character, Britannica, because she has a British accent. But yeah, and so, it's essentially, it's an underdog sports movie because it's this ragtag group of people who have absolutely no idea what they're doing, and will they be able to come together as a team? Will they be able to come together and put on a show? Will they be able to put aside personal disagreements and blah, blah, blah? Well, yeah, probably to some degree they will. That's the convention. But it's 10 episodes. It is being treated as really and truly a dramedy. It's episodes run between 35 and 29 minutes. So they didn't cut it down to comedy length. They didn't pad episodes to get it to an hour per. So you can watch the episodes in, the season in 5 hours, easy in, easy out. And it gets better as it goes along because you find out who these women are. They start off as stereotypes and they become characters, and it's really nicely done how by the end of 10 episodes you have a fair amount of warmth for these characters. And it's not hilarious, but there are some good laughs, there's some reasonable emotion, etc.
All right, I'm really looking forward to it. And now, speaking of Netflix, we're on Netflix here. You have seen season 5 of Orange is the New Black, and
I've seen 10 episodes of the season. They sent all of it out, and at this point, there's just so much TV that my gotta watch every episode before reviewing things policy, which has dated back to the beginning of my career in this business, it no longer applies anymore. It just can't, because sometimes you can only get to so many episodes. But yeah, I've seen 10 of the episodes.
So what do you think?
I think it's a mess. I think it's an interesting mess. But I also understand why some fans are going to hate it. And I'll be very interested to see how the reactions last as we have to now wait another year for more episodes. The season is all following in the aftermath of where the fourth season ended, which was with one of the characters holding a gun on a guard as the prison was on the brink of a riot. And the season that premiered last week takes place all within the 3 days immediately following that event.
Oh,
which
wow.
which is not the way that Orange is the New Black has ever functioned before. And all of the structure that came from the regimented existence of being in a prison is basically gone, and it's anarchy, and it's kind of narrative anarchy as well, and it doesn't always benefit the show. There are a lot of new pairings of characters that don't necessarily work. There are a lot of big swing attempts to do strange different kinds of episodes. There's an episode that's basically a slasher movie and where they make references to slasher movies, and you go, what TV show exactly am I watching? This is not Orange is the New Black. It's a kind of weird other thing. But I still admired it for, the audacity of trying to do as many different things as it did when it would have been perfectly easy to just go along doing the same thing. But some people are really going to wish that they had gone along and done the same thing.
Yeah, I haven't started it. I mean, I've seen every episode up until this new season, and I like the show. I don't think it's great. I've never really thought it was great, but I always do watch it. But I've heard friends of mine who had started it said that they weren't crazy about it. All right, Dan, hang on.
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. We got the news coming up, and afterwards we will talk more TV. And you can follow Dan on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran with your morning drive at 6. We're going to have a little pop-up video a little bit later on and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Triple play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. 312-981-7200. All right, welcome back. Let's get back to our conversation. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. And we welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay, so Handmaid's Tale is done for the season. I know.
I mean, on one hand, it's partially a relief because you know, how much intensity, how many weeks of consecutive intensity can you deal with? On the other hand, anytime a good show goes away, and there are entirely too many good shows that are on the verge of going away suddenly, it's sad.
Yeah, it's funny because my Wednesdays for the past few weeks have been fantastic. In the morning, when I get home from work, I would watch Handmaid's Tale, and then in the evening, I would watch Fargo. And now, after next week, I won't even have Fargo anymore. I thought Handmaid's Tale, we've talked about it before and how I felt about it. I think it's amazing, and I thought the finale was incredible, absolutely incredible. And, God, Elizabeth Moss, I don't even know. I mean, the scene in the – I won't give it away, but she's in the back of a limo at one point in a car, and something happens, and she wants to get out of the car. That is just – and then her response to the person, you know – who's responsible for putting her through this is unbelievable. So I just thought the whole thing was amazing. And it ended on such a crazy note. And I thought the episode was pretty astonishing, as I did the entire season.
I thought that the finale was probably the best episode since probably the third episode, I think. Mm. I think that was, definitely I had enjoyed throughout, but I thought the finale was a step up. Yeah. I thought the finale was harrowing and hard to watch, but in a breathless, high tension, high drama, astoundingly acted way.
Yeah.
It definitely, you know, again, Elizabeth Moss, unbelievable. I suspect with each passing week that it will be more and more inevitable that she will just win the Emmy, and that is fine.
Yeah.
Because she deserves it. She's great. Samira Wiley has a couple great moments in the finale. Yvonne Strahovski, dynamite. Yep. Just really getting more and more impressive.
Yep.
Each week as they give her more to do, basically, and they sort of show this woman, you know, in all of her complexity, and she's not necessarily just a villain, but she's pretty awful, and there's a lot of dark stuff and doubt. Another great episode for her, and just so beautifully shot. Mm. And the lighting throughout the entire episode is just breathtaking, scene to scene to scene to scene. Several great musical cues, just really a great final episode. Yeah. and a good way to tie up a first season.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it was great. I don't know if you did. You see Elizabeth Moss on Seth Meyers last week?
I did indeed. She was utterly charming, whether one happens to be a Cubs fan
that's what I was gonna say, because I had no idea she was a Cub fan, and I you know, and I'm watching this and I'm like, I didn't think it was possible for me to love Elizabeth Moss more. But when they showed that picture of her with the bruise makeup on her forehead, with the bonnet on, wearing the Cubs shirt, I was like, that's it. I officially want to marry this woman.
The picture from the end of the World Series that happened to line up with production on the harrowing finale of the series of the season, rather, not the series.
Right.
It was perfect. And yeah. And yes, she was, that was a very good, I mean, she's a great talk show guest.
Yeah.
That's another one of her skills.
The other thing is we're going to lose Handmaid's Tale, but when does Top of the Lake start?
It doesn't start until fall.
There's a
gap here. I mean, honestly, I need to write something about this next week. If you've had things on your DVR or on your Netflix queue or on your Hulu queue that you've been waiting to get to, you've got, say, a month to get to them. And then Game of Thrones comes back, and then a bunch of other stuff starts coming back, and heck, then it's fall again. But, this could be the closest window to a catch-up time that there is in the year. So if you've been waiting, catch up now.
Okay, good, because I have to catch up on The Leftovers. So I know, and I understand. So I have to catch up on the, you know.
It's perfect, because if you've been feeling as if your life kind of requires this adrenaline jolt of misery and strangeness and paranoia,
right,
simply start watching Leftovers and just fill it in. It's easy. Yeah. And also, if you feel like you've been enjoying having Carrie Coon in your life every Wednesday. So easy. It'll kill two birds with one stone.
Exactly what that's my plan, Dan. That's my plan.
Perfect.
Let's talk a little bit about the Comedy Central show, the Jim Jefferies show. I know you reviewed it, and I read your review, and I agree with what you say about it. I happen to be a really big fan of Jim Jefferies. I think he's great, and he's a terrific stand-up. I, like you, find flaws in how they've given him this show and what the structure of the show is. Tell everybody about it.
What it is it's just another late-night comedy news show that hasn't yet figured out exactly how to make use of Jim Jefferies' voice, which is a very distinctive and very funny voice. And I think that if they find a way to kind of capture what Jim Jefferies does in his stand-up, to capture the kind of more grounded humanity that he brought to the short-lived FX and FXX show Legit, I think that he really does have a place on television. And I think this is the kind of show that could have longevity and real value. I just don't know that the first two episodes have exhibited that. It's been very much by the numbers, opening monologue with the headlines, middle stuff with Jim Jefferies going on the road to foreign countries and being surprised by how backwards things are, come back to a slightly longer, slightly more in-depth comedy piece, and then for the first two episodes, Brad Pitt reads the weather.
Right.
And I'm sure someone has done an interview to explain how exactly Brad Pitt came to be the Jim Jefferies show weatherman, at least short term, because I don't instantly get it, but I'm sure there's an answer. And it's been funny to see. But yeah, to me, I need more of it to be specifically Jim Jefferies, not just somebody writing comedy for almost anyone to do. Talking about Donald Trump. So I need more Jim Jefferies. I need less generic, but I'll keep watching because, like you, I think that Jim Jefferies is very talented and has a worthwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel exactly the same way that you do. Now, have you watched The President Show?
I've watched a little bit of it, and I respect what he's doing an awful lot. I don't need it because there's too much.
Yeah, I actually really love it. I think it's crazy and weird, and I think he's pretty. I mean, I think his impression is spot on, terrifying, and better than Baldwin's.
I think it's definitely better than Baldwin's, but I think Baldwin's sort of calcified very, very quickly.
Right.
I think that this is a much more, calculated and thoughtful and in-depth impression, but that's probably why I can't watch it. I can watch a couple clips. It's become one of those shows where, a little bit like Billy on the Street almost. They're not really similar, but they're similar in the sense that I've fallen into a rhythm where I'm happy to watch 5 minutes per episode and that the world tells me I need to watch and not the whole thing.
Gotcha. All right. How are you navigating Twin Peaks, Dan?
You mean the Dougie show?
I did the Dougie show.
Oh, man. So much Dougie. I would be hurt. Like, if you asked me what happened on this past week's episode, I would say, well, I think there was a lot of Dougie. I think Dougie went through papers for some reason. And Naomi Watts stood up to some bookies, and that was interesting. And then there was some really rather intense violence that kind of came out of nowhere. But, that's what the show is. But it was a lot of Dougie, and we've settled into a lot of Dougie, and I don't know how to feel about Dougie. How do you feel about Dougie?
I love Dougie, and I have to say, you mentioned Naomi Watts. I think Naomi Watts is phenomenal on the show. I think she's so funny, and just navigating this weird world. I don't know. I think she's my favorite performance so far on the show. My favorite performance is Naomi Watts. I just think she's great. And of course, she has to play off of Kyle MacLachlan, who's doing this Dougie thing, which is just, I don't know what to make of the show on a weekly basis. Like, when it's over, I'm like, what the hell was that? And I still am mesmerized by it. I can't take my eyes off the screen. And I love it. And I love the insane amount of cameos. like every week. And like this week, Harry Dean Stanton shows up, and that's a subplot that was like, what the hell is going on? And then one shot of Laura Dern with an insane wig on, and I'm like, okay, I'm on board for this train ride. I don't know where the hell we're going or what's happening, but I'm loving it.
I definitely am with you on the, it gets to the end of an episode and suddenly I tried to, like, I'm so relieved that I am not one of the people who has to attempt to recap this on a weekly basis. Those people are the screw heroes and long may they survive. No, I would not be able to tell you what happened. Definitely in its best moments, I've been transfixed. This week, maybe I felt like I had a few fewer than maybe a couple weeks before, but on the other hand, the sort of moments of horrifying and abrupt violence hit really hard.
Yeah.
And they were clearly supposed to, and they clearly hit harder because you've been watching Dougie be Dougie for, I don't know, feels like there was like, you know, 2 hours of Dougie this past week, just, you know, standing in the elevator and sipping coffee and stuff. At least this episode wasn't all based on Dougie learning to urinate, which I think the previous week was how do we teach Dougie that he can go to the bathroom? I'm just astounded by, like, it's almost like an Andy Kaufman performance.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. It's just crazy.
And it's the Andy Kaufman performances between McLaughlin and David Lynch, where it becomes this: how long can we go with this thing that we're doing? And I respect the hell out of the performance that Kyle MacLachlan has given.
Oh, yeah.
It is committed and weird and strange and funny in ways that I'm not sure I knew he was.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still mystified by what the show is.
Yeah, me too. I don't think we're ever going to understand the damn thing, but I'm glad it exists, and I'm glad I get to watch it every week. We're running out of time, Dan, but I do want to mention the show that follows it, and I'm really enjoying I'm Dying Up Here. I really like it a lot. I think it's a really good show. I love the cast, and I think I'm a fan of it. I think it's a good show.
You're going to need to keep telling people that because no one's watching it, and so it's going to have a very short life if people do not hook on to that show, because at this point, ratings not so very impressive for I'm Dying Up Here.
All right. I'll talk about it. I'll talk it up, and we'll get
– excellent.
But I'm sure one more person will watch it. So, all right, Dan, always a pleasure, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks, okay?
Sounds good, Nick.
Okay, Dan, take care. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody. He's great. And he joins us every 2 weeks. You can read him on The Hollywood Reporter and follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN.